You know, there are some fundamental issues with China that need to be addressed. On the other hand, he likes to cut a deal, a quick deal. And those two desires are inconsistent.
A trade truce is struck, for now. It's Monday, December 3rd. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, President Trump speaks with VOA at the G20 summit. Tackling smoking among Aborigines. China and Russia stress test national resolve. Spiders caring for their young. Holiday trains on the roll. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The world's two largest economies, the United States and China, have agreed to a small truce in their escalating trade war after a meeting between Presidents Donald Trump and Xi Jinping following the G20 summit. Trump, speaking to reporters on Air Force One after the plane departed Argentina, said his agreement made over dinner with Xi will go down as one of the largest deals ever made, and it will have an incredibly positive impact on farming, meaning agriculture, industrial products, computers, and every type of product.
It is a small truce. It means that for the moment, the more pragmatic set of advisors for the president have won out, and they're pushing for talks that might lead to a lowering of tariff barriers. I think I would expect, though, that we have not solved this problem for the long run, because the other set of advisors, the ones who cautioned exactly against accepting some baubles and ongoing talks, they're still there, and I can't imagine they like this one bit.
Where do you think Trump really stands on this?
I think President Trump wavers. I think on the one hand, he buys into many of the critiques that, you know, there's fundamental issues with China that need to be addressed. On the other hand, he likes to cut a deal and a quick deal. And those two desires are inconsistent. The kind of problems that they've been flagging with China, such as subsidies, regulatory problems, intellectual property issues, those are things that are difficult and subtle and take a long time to work out. They're not things you fix over dinner. So what we end up with is sort of an awkward compromise where you give yourself 90 days to tackle problems that have plagued us for years.
What do you think happens next? What are the next steps here?
They've given themselves a very short time frame. I mean, they're talking about 90 days, and it's worth remembering that's 90 days that contain, you know, Christmas and New Year's in the U.S. and then Chinese New Year for them. So this is not much time to work on things. I think we have a little stretch here where we've essentially postponed tariffs for 2 months, and then the Trump administration is going to have to make a decision. Do they snap back to their escalation and complaints, or do they try for some face-saving resolution?
You can't be in their shoes, as you can't be in the U.S. negotiator's shoes, but as far as the Chinese are concerned, where do you think they're coming from?
I think the Chinese have found the Trump administration baffling. It's worth remembering, this is not the first deal that the Trump administration has struck, nor is it even the first deal that that President Trump has, you know, paraded around as a fantastic, fabulous, you know, historic agreement. We had one in the spring of his very first year. And then after the glow wore off, they went right back to doing trade battles. He had his visit to Beijing in November of last year. It was wonderful. It was fabulous. No one's ever been treated as nicely. And then they launched into all of these tariffs. So I think the Chinese think they're playing for time, and they'll just take whatever comes next.
I'm trying to figure out where Xi Jinping might go from here beside waiting. Are there any steps he might take, either positively or negatively, to go further?
I think there's a range of things that China can do which are within sort of a reasonable realm. I think it has probably come as a bit of a shock to them the extent to which they have lost the support of the U.S. business community. And you've seen requests coming out of the U.S. business community, things that they could do in terms of treating foreign investment, in terms of dealing with intellectual property. He would be well advised to try and address some of those concerns that have been raised. There's also the sort of very standard offers that one can make of lowering some tariffs, agreeing to make some extra purchases. And I think they've tried that, although they didn't lay out the details after this dinner. That's my guess of his next move. if the holdout is for fundamental deep Chinese reforms at, you know, U.S. insistence, that's not going to happen, at least not in the very short run.
The two of us have talked in the past about the security that China was offered, or lack of so. And you have apparently some promises when it comes to that. And you also have the agreement by China to designate fentanyl as a controlled substance. But what are your reactions to those things?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, so we saw these two things which do not count as traditional trade issues. One, the fentanyl, and then the other, some talk about how to deal with North Korea, that were both raised. I think this is China pulling some strings and reminding the president that there's other aspects to this relationship and it may be worth preserving. So these were things that allowed the president a bit more of a face-saving exit from the tariffs he had planned, or at least a postponement. It's that what was not touched were the kind of security concerns that Vice President Mike Pence raised a month or two ago about China. So that kind of cuts both ways. In this case, it was used as an excuse to postpone the tariffs.
Phil Levy is a senior fellow on the global economy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, speaking via Skype with VOA's Ira Melman. President Trump agreed that he will leave the tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese products at the 10% rate and not raise it to 25% for now, as he had threatened to do come January 1st, according to a White House statement. Phil Levy, from 2003 to 2006, served first as a senior economist for trade for President George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisers, and then as a member of the Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's policy planning staff, covering international economic matters. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now on voanews.com. Truce in trade war after Trump sees Jinner in Argentina. Next Trump-Kim meeting likely early next year. Program tackles sky-high rates of Aboriginal smoking in Australia. Australia's survey reveals psychological stress on emergency workers. South Korea says North Korea's soldier defects to the South. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. We also invite you to stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. President Trump had comments about China and other topics at the G20 summit in Argentina, which he shared with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren.
As you call out China as one of the countries you say is ripping off the United States, China's global footprint is expanding. They're all over North Africa. They're building a huge port in Pakistan. They have great deals, investment deals in Panama and Latin America, sort of coming very close to the United States geographically. Do you trust the strategic goals of China, or are you a little bit worried?
Well, I think they're going to have less money than they have right now because the deal that I'm making, if you look at, we have $250 billion right now at 25%. That means we're going to be taking in billions and billions of dollars. Plus, I can double that up and then I can double it again. And they could never do what they did in the past with other presidents because, and you see what's happening. I mean, China is, I don't want to do this, but they are not doing very well now compared to what they were doing. And again, I think that we are doing well. We picked up $11.7 trillion in worth since my election, and China's lost a great deal of worth. And we are now a much bigger economy than China, which a lot of people don't know, but we're much bigger and really a much more powerful economy than China.
But as a national security point, you know, with their investment in Latin America and all over the world, it does seem that they're making a bigger footprint around the world.
I know, but they have a debt problem, and they have to pay for that debt. It's a tremendous amount of money that they're spending. Do I like it? Probably not, but I also know it's very expensive for them, and a lot of those places aren't going to work out.
One of the issues of a global economy is climate change. That's a discussion here. What's your position on climate change and how it has an effect on the economy worldwide?
Very simple. I want the cleanest air and the cleanest water on the planet. I want crystal clean water, and that's what we have. We've been doing very well with respect to the environment, and that's what I want. But I'm not going to put the country out of business trying to maintain certain standards that probably don't matter. When you look at China and when you look at other countries where they have very, you know, foul air, they have not good air, that comes over to the United States. You know, people don't want to talk about it, but it comes over. So we're going to be clean, but they're not, and it costs a lot of money. Well, the fact is we are absolutely clean, but we're not going to spend trillions of dollars and make it good for others, but not make it good for, you know, I have a very simple policy. It's called America First. At the same time, we're going to be a great neighbor to the world, but we have to treat ourselves fairly. So that's the way it is.
All right. Now, our domestic economy. Next week, there's a vote possibly on a government shutdown. First of all, do you think there is going to be a U.S. government shutdown, and does that have any sort of global economic impact?
Well, I can't tell you if there's going to be a shutdown because nobody knows. But I will tell you, we're going to have border security. We're going to have a lot of border security. You saw what we did with the all of the caravans coming up, and now they're starting to head out. They're starting to go back. But we are going to have security. We're not going to let people come into our country illegally. We're going to have people come in on merit. We need people. You know, we have the lowest unemployment rate we've had in 51 years. We need people in this country. We have companies moving in. In fact, Prime Minister Abe of Japan just told me they're moving two big car companies. They're going to be opening up two massive plants. You know, you don't hear that often, but a lot of that is happening. You hear about a General Motors, and I don't know what happened with General Motors, but the trend is exactly the opposite. And I will say this, our economy has never done better. We're doing unbelievable numbers. You see that. And a lot of good things are happening.
All right. One last question, and I'll give you a chance to educate there, or at least talk about the American media. What is it the U.S. media collectively doesn't understand about the economy? When you look at things, you hear our reporting. Any thoughts about our reporting?
Well, I think they understand the economy. They know how well we're doing. They just don't like to say it because that's good for me. So they don't want to say it. You know, look, I call it fake news. I don't say the media. I say you have so much false reporting. But we have a phenomenal economy. They know that. Look, we have the best unemployment numbers as a group that we've ever had. You look at African-American unemployment and Asian and Hispanic-American, you look at all of it, they're the best numbers in history. The best, I mean, these are historic lows. So the media knows how well we're doing. They tend not to want to write it.
So you like discussing the economy of these world leaders?
I do. I mean, we have the best economy in the world. Actually, every leader came up to me virtually, and they said, congratulations on the great economy.
Mr. President, nice to see you.
Thank you, Greta.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. Nice. Thank you very much.
Happening now in Asia, the World Health Organization says Pakistan is registering approximately 20,000 new HIV infections annually, the highest rate of increase among all countries in the region. The latest government figures show only 16% of the estimated 150,000 HIV-infected people have been tested. Just 9% have access to life-saving treatment. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us as we both start out a fresh week on VOA Asia. A new program in Sydney is helping Indigenous Australians quit smoking. It's also exploring the deeper reasons why about a third of Aboriginal adults smoke, a much higher proportion than the national average. Phil Mercer in Sydney tells us the organizers of the Talking About Tobacco Use Project are warning that high smoking rates are the biggest risk to poor health among Australia's original inhabitants.
First time I quit, had no idea what I was getting myself into. I lasted 3 days and some bright spark gave me a beer. Well, the second time was better. I lasted 6 weeks until my girlfriend decided I was too cranky and gave me a cigarette.
Public health campaigns have helped smoking rates in Australia to fall steadily. But tobacco use in Indigenous communities remains stubbornly high. About a third of Aboriginal adults smoke, including Simone Jordan, an Aboriginal leader involved in setting up a centre in Sydney that's designed to help Australia's original inhabitants give up cigarettes. Jordan is also a participant in the program.
Most of my family did smoke, and it wasn't seen as a bad thing. It wasn't discouraged, and I guess I just thought I was cool for doing it. I guess the goal for us is to get people to quit, help them, make them feel good about it, encourage others. If they fall over, they're not a failure. There's other things we can try and share with people what's working and what's not.
Indigenous Australians die on average 10 years before their non-Aboriginal counterparts. High rates of poverty, inadequate housing, and alcohol and drug abuse are in part to blame. But Professor Renee Bittoon, a tobacco treatment specialist, says that smoking causes immense damage.
It's a huge contributor. It's probably the biggest contributor. I'm not saying that other substances aren't a big concern, and they are, but the medical consequences, it's nothing like smoking.
Australia was settled by the British in 1788. Academics argue that high rates of smoking among Aboriginal people are due in part to colonisation. Tobacco was a de facto currency and was widely used in state or church-run missions, where many Indigenous Australians were sent to live in the 19th century in an attempt to assimilate them or to convert them to Christianity. Dr. Raymond Lovett is an epidemiologist at the Australian National University.
Tobacco was used right up until the recent past as payment for labour, and it was also part of the mission rations. Obviously, that legacy has produced this really high smoking prevalence.
Smoking isn't a traditional part of Aboriginal culture, but in some remote settlements, one in two adults smoke. Indigenous Australians make up about 3% of Australia's national population of 25 million people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, trying to test how far a nation will tolerate aggression. You're listening to VOA Asia. The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news from VOA Asia. President Donald Trump says he expects to meet with North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un in January or February. He told reporters on board Air Force One on his way back from the G20 summit in Argentina that three sites for the meeting are under consideration, but declined to identify them. Your site to visit daily is VOA Asia Facebook. See and share our stories. As VOA Asia continues, Russia and China are among several countries attempting to stress test the resolve of traditional powers. That's according to a report from the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. It claims so-called challenger powers are persistently testing the West's tolerance for different forms of aggression, from proxy wars to cyber attacks. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Russian forces this week seized three Ukrainian naval vessels in the Sea of Azov off Crimea, the territory Russia forcibly annexed in 2014. Moscow claims these are Russian waters, but a 2003 deal between Moscow and Ukraine agreed the Sea of Azov would be shared. Ukraine warns its Black Sea ports are being cut off. A bridge built by Russia linking it with Crimea now limits the size of ships able to navigate the Kerch Strait. The aim is to change the facts on the ground, part of the Kremlin's strategy of stress-testing the West, says the co-author of the Strategic Survey report, Nick Redman.
They're testing tolerances, probing for weaknesses, getting a measure of the resolve of other states by acts that are generally aggressive but are below the threshold of something that would obviously require a military response.
The IISS report describes a contest between settled versus challenger powers. Iran is also accused of conducting tolerance warfare, using the Revolutionary Guards Corps and proxies across the Middle East to destabilize other countries like Syria. Beijing's activities in the South China Sea are also seen as part of a strategy to test Western resolve in that arena.
China has used not its navy, but say its coast guard or some other at-water capabilities in order to slowly push the envelope in the South China Sea, and obviously the island building campaign, and then the growth of infrastructure around there is about, without directly confronting anyone, nevertheless changing facts on the ground.
So how should those on the receiving end of tolerance warfare respond? Redman cites Britain's reaction to the attempted chemical poisoning of a former double agent on British soil earlier this year, which London blamed on the GRU, the intelligence branch of Russia's armed forces.
What we saw was a powerful asymmetric response. Sanctions, tremendous degree of allied solidarity over diplomatic expulsions, and then an information operation over several months to systematically expose GRU activity.
The report's authors say a new era of geopolitical competition urgently requires new rules governing international behaviour. But negotiating such a global framework is fraught with difficulty. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This news from VOA Asia. The United States and China have agreed to a small truce in their escalating trade war. President Trump, speaking to reporters on Air Force One after the plane departed the G20 summit, said his agreement over dinner with Chinese President Xi Jinping will go down as one of the largest deals ever made. There's more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, some spiders actually take care of their young. VOA's Rick Pantaleo takes a moment to explain.
This is Science in a Minute.
Mammals are a class of animals that are best known for their ability to nourish their young with milk produced by the mammary glands of females. Now a team of Chinese researchers say they have found that the young offspring of one jumping spider species is completely reliant on the nutritive spider milk discharged and fed to them by their mothers. Writing in a study published by the journal Science, the researchers also say they found that the jumping spider mothers continue to care for and nurse her young spiderlings into young adulthood, even after they have already learned to find food and feed themselves. The study suggests that the spider's milk has 4 times the protein of cow's milk. Scientists have previously found that other non-mammalian species, such as the pigeon and flamingo, are also known to nurse their young with mother's milk. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Every year, thousands of visitors come to the U.S. Botanic Garden here in Washington to enjoy the Christmas decorations, holiday plants, and model trains. This year, the garden has its largest ever display of toy trains chugging around historic railroad stations in the United States. As we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, the railroad stations are made from some unusual materials.
It is cold outside in Washington, but there is a warm glow inside the U.S. Botanic Garden during the Christmas season. This year, the garden is featuring 31 replicas of historic U.S. train stations built from the 1800s to 1970.
Trains really celebrate the holiday season for people from 2 to 92.
Kashmira Bhatti came to see the trains with her son.
He likes that the trains are moving, and he can see the train station and the surrounding of the train station too. So it's more like an educational thing for him, and plus entertainment too.
The amazing displays are reminiscent of the popular model trains that circled under Christmas trees for 50 years during the last century, from 1910 to 1960. And while the trains may be a new experience for kids, they bring back nostalgia for adults old enough to remember them. Also showcased are two of the largest indoor decorated Christmas trees in Washington, as well as more than 3,000 poinsettia plants, also known as the Christmas flower. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Tis the season to hear our program on the radio. U-Radio of Hachai University, FM 101.25 at Hachai University in Thailand. We thank everyone there who is tuned in today. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Aiden Utku, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our great VOA Asia team. That includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we wish you a great day ahead.